100%. I find all the women with disease, but look how many more false positives I have. My specificity went from 98.5.
Oh, where am I put it? Yep. Yep, it's connected.
Is it too loud?
Probably once I really start talking. Hi. Hi, everybody. Is this a good volume? In general? Yes, no. Nobody's responding. Okay. The beginning. As far as I know.
She records all of her life. Oh, it's recording. Okay. All right. Cool.
No laser pointer?
No. Is that that she gave back to Rebecca?
It's not a big deal. I'm going to move this out from front of the board, though.
I mean, know if you need me to get anything or something.
Okay.
I need this so I can take notes. Is there a pen?
Thank you. All right, we have a really long lecture today, actually, so I'm going to go ahead and get started, and hopefully a couple more people will trickle in. I'm Stephanie. I'm one of your TAs. You get lots of emails from me if we haven't met before. Hi. Welcome back from spring break. I hope everybody had a fun and relaxing time and is ready to get started again. I know I'm not, but so it goes. Lecture 16. Let's have a brief review because I know it's been a long time since before spring break, since our last lecture. And we're going to just review Dr. Koop, where he was. Ooh, I have a laser pointer. Okay. Here, anybody? Good. Okay. Here. Can you find him at all? There he is. Good job. All right. Here. All right. There's at least one person in this class who knows what's going on. How about now? Okay. I heard it. Nuclear pour. Okay. Again. Whee. Here. I'm going with sea turtle. Okay. I'll take that one, too. And where is he? Oh, there he is. Well done. Okay. So we're going to go real quickly and watch that last chapter of the microarray. Nobody can hear that, can they? Right, okay. Well, let me pause this. I'm like, I can hear it. What's wrong with you guys? Oh. Well done. Okay. Problem solved. Oh, hang on. This might not be the best way to do this. Let me re-find that. We're back on.
So in this experiment, we did a biopsy on a patient that had cancer. So we compare that to her normal tissue.
Which gene you turned on, a cervical cancer developed.
Yeah.
Okay. So what do you actually put on the slide then?
So my reference would be her normal tissue.
Okay. What color is that?
And that's green.
Okay.
And the cancerous tissue is labeled red.
And so how do you tell where there's red and where there's green on the slide?
Well, we put it in a scanner like this and take an image of it.
All right.
And let's go ahead and do it. Sure.
So what's inside this big blue box?
Well, there's a light source, a detector, and some filters.
Okay.
And this will let us take a picture of that array.
So basically, it's just a microscope and it'll let you look at what color each spot is.
Yeah.
And how long does it take to make this?
Just about 10 minutes.
Okay. Can we take a look at what a picture looks like in the car?
Sure. Let's look at the computer. So now we've taken an image of our microarray.
Okay. And so each of those spots corresponds to one of the spots on the slide?
Yes. Take a closer look.
Okay.
Each of these dots is a spot and represents one gene.
So what are the colors? I mean, some are black and some are green and yellow and red. What does that mean?
So the green are the genes that are active in our reference sample.
Okay.
The red are the genes that are active in our experimental sample,
uh-huh.
cancer.
Okay.
The black spots are genes that were not active in either.
Okay, what about yellow?
Yeah, so the yellow spots are genes that were active in both the normal and the experimental sample.
Okay, okay. So you have to make a color image then of what kind of cells. Okay. And what do you do with images like this?
Now we grid each image, mm-hmm. so this tells the computer where the spots are,
okay.
and we'll go through and extract the pixel intensities from each spot.
Okay, how bright it is?
Exactly.
Okay.
And that tells us what levels the genes are expressed in each state.
And you're going to do that for all of the spots?
For all 50,000 spots.
So do you use a computer program to do that grading and get that information?
Yes, but it's not perfect, so there's a lot of manual manipulation.
How long does it take to download the information from the slide then?
To grid a human array, it can take 3 to 4 hours just to get everything ready.
Uh-huh.
The computer or software can analyze all the data in just a matter of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
We take that data later and upload it to a database where mm-hmm. we can visualize and manipulate the data.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how do I know what gene that is?
We know which gene is in each well from that plate,
okay.
and we know where it is when we
right.
you know, where it is when we printed it, and we record that information so we know each spot.
Okay. Can you show us what it looks like after you've graded it?
Sure. Well, add our grid.
So now there's 50,000 little spots there.
Yep.
Okay.
And now let's zoom in on one.
Okay.
And we
they're not perfect, huh?
They're not perfect, and we'll see if the computer can find everything.
So it moves them around, and I see some of them are a lot smaller now.
Yeah. So it does a diameter adjustment,
okay.
And then it tries to identify the spots.
Yeah. Is that because it doesn't print all the same size spots?
Yes, and during the print, we try and keep everything steady, but there's still a little bit of wobble.
Okay. So you have to go and move them over?
Yeah.
Oh, man. You must go blind.
After a while, that's just two spots. But the software will let us see each of the colors.
Oh, so I see, yeah.
The green from our normal.
We're looking at this spot right here, which looks kind of orange to me.
So the green from our normal,
uh-huh.
The red from our experimental,
right.
And then the combined.
And so that's how you know how much of each is there. And so if you're looking at the difference between, say, normal tissue and cervical cancer, how many genes are different?
There can be hundreds or thousands of genes that are slightly different,
uh-huh.
But when we really zoom in and look at the ones that are statistically significant,
yeah.
It'll probably be maybe 60 genes.
So maybe a lot of the differences just arise due to chance.
Exactly.
So how many patients do you have to look at to know whether the differences are due to chance or whether they're real and associated with the cancer?
Most people look at least 30 different patients. The more the better.
Mm-hmm. So how long does it take to get data from 30 patients and download it to the computer?
We can get a patient maybe once a week.
Mm-hmm.
The experiment should take about a week to do.
Uh-huh.
And obviously grading takes a long time.
So we're talking maybe a year of investment to do one of these experiments.
Yes.
Have you found some interesting differences so far in your research?
Our study is still in the beginning stages, but we are finding some differences.
What genes appear to be different?
A lot of genes that are involved in metabolism,
mm-hmm.
So the cancerous genes tend to be more metabolically active,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of checkpoint genes are not active,
mm-hmm.
So there's less control over what the cell is actually doing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Interesting. Well, good luck with your experiment.
Thanks.
Okay. So we watched that. Ooh, I'm really loud now. At the beginning of the course, you remember we kind of divided the course into four main parts. So we were going to talk about what the major health problems worldwide were. Yeah, I think so. Is that better, guys? Okay. Who pays to solve those problems? How technology can help to solve those problems, and how these healthcare technologies are managed. We're now on the third segment of that, and we've actually been on the third segment for a little while. We talked about, still pretty loud? We talked about, oh dear, sorry. Yeah. I'm like, I don't know. Let me see if I close this, if that helps. There we go. Sorry, guys. Okay, so we talked a little bit about infectious diseases, and then we talked a lot about cancer. We're now on heart disease. And so in this big scale of things, we are here. We're going to talk a little bit about just introduction to the circulatory system. Probably a lot of you have seen this before, at least in some level of detail, what risk factors are for different types of heart disease. And then we'll talk about arteriosclerosis, as well as some of the therapies that can be used to treat that, like CABG, which is coronary artery bypass graft, and PTCA, which is percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty. And then also we'll talk a little bit about heart failure and the options to treat that, which include transplant and LVAD, which is left ventricular assist device. Talk about outcomes and cost effectiveness. general outline for today. So globally, what is the burden of cardiovascular disease? It has contributed in 1999 to a third of global deaths, so it's pretty significant. In 2003, 16.7 million deaths worldwide. And by 2010, it's estimated that it will be the leading cause of death in developing countries. And as we'll see, it's already a leading cause of death in developed countries. If you look at worldwide mortality, in the younger age group, 15 to 59, which would be the age group that you all are in, it is ischemic heart disease is the second leading cause of death. Now, if you looked just at your age group, it probably would be a little bit lower. You would see things like road traffic injuries, self-inflicted injuries, and violence in the United States are the biggest causes for this age group. But when you start including some of these people going up to age 60, then you can see that ischemic heart disease rises very quickly. If you look at adults age 60 plus, ischemic heart disease is number one, and hypertensive heart disease is number seven. So heart disease overall is a huge killer. If you look at developing countries, and here this is divided into low mortality developing countries and high mortality developing countries. So the high mortality developing countries would be ones where you have a lot of problem with AIDS or with war or where people are tending to die earlier anyway. You can see in both cases, cardiovascular diseases are still a huge cause of death. If you look just at the United States, about 61 million Americans, which makes up almost a quarter of the population, have some sort of cardiovascular disease. And it accounts for more than 40% of all deaths. Almost a million Americans will die of cardiovascular disease each year. And the two main forms of cardiovascular disease, and two forms that we'll talk about today, are ischemic heart disease and stroke. Ischemic heart disease, as we saw before, is a leading cause of death in the United States. It's also a leading cause of premature disability among working adults. And so even beyond just the number of deaths it causes, there's a huge social burden where people become disabled due to this disease. Stroke is the third leading cause of death in the United States. Overall, if you look at both healthcare expenditures and lost productivity from death and disability, we're talking $351 billion in the U.S. alone to treat and as a result of cardiovascular disease. So it's clearly a huge problem. What is ischemic heart disease? This is heart disease where your heart is not getting enough oxygen to work. It's caused by narrowing of the coronary arteries, often due to plaque buildup, and it can result in a heart attack, which is actually where the heart muscle does not receive enough oxygen and actually the cells die, which you can see would be a little bit of a problem when you're trying to get your heart to do things. Each year, over a million Americans suffer a heart attack. Almost half of these are fatal. And half of the deaths will occur within 1 hour of the symptom onset before the person reaches the hospital. And this is known as sudden cardiac death. As far as early detection goes, it's important to know what your risk factors are. A huge risk factor is tobacco use. And this is one of the ones that's, in many ways, most in your control, because you can just not use tobacco. And that makes you much less likely to have this kind of problem. Low levels of physical activity, inappropriate diet, although what is the best diet changes, it seems like, about every week. High blood pressure is huge, and many people who have high blood pressure are not able to control that blood pressure. Similarly, high cholesterol is a huge problem, and over 80% of people with high cholesterol are unable to keep that cholesterol under control. As far as screening for cardiovascular disease, it's best to get your blood pressure taken once annually. And actually, later in this lecture, you'll get a chance to take each other's blood pressure, which will be kind of fun, hopefully. If you can reduce your blood pressure 12 to 13 points, you can reduce the number of heart attacks by 21%. Similarly, cholesterol checks are recommended every 5 years, starting when you're about 25. And a 10% drop in cholesterol can reduce your risk of a heart attack by 30%. If you look at people with high blood pressure, Yeah, I'm about to turn 25. I had one last year, so they started a little early with me. But you don't see the results of having high cholesterol usually until you're much older. But if you look at, when they look at like histological sections of people's arteries, starting in their late teens, early 20s, most people will have evidence of cholesterol buildup in their arteries. Scary thought. If you look at Americans who have high blood pressure and how many of those do not have that blood pressure under control, you can see across all different race and ethnic groups, it's between 70 and 80%. So it's obviously very difficult to control, and very few people are able to effectively do that and thus prevent their or reduce their risk of heart attacks. My blood pressure thing is actually Dr. Richard Cordham's blood pressure, although mine's around there. I think my systolic's a little bit higher generally. This higher number, the 103 here, is the pressure when the heart pushes the blood through. The lower number is when the heart muscle relaxes. And they kind of represent the extremes of the pressures that your vessels are experiencing. If you look at normal blood pressure, your blood pressure is going to change depending on whether you're sitting there, whether you're walking or running, doing different things. If you're nervous about giving a lecture, something like that, your blood pressure could go up. It also can vary with changes in posture, although hopefully it's not going to vary too much. But less than 20 millimeters of mercury difference in blood pressure between when you're laying down and when you're standing up is considered normal. If you get above that, then you have to start looking at why is this person not able to control their blood pressure appropriately? Because your body has all these compensatory mechanisms so that when you change the relationship of your heart to your brain's still getting the same amount of blood to it. And the recommendations are that it should be less than 120 over 80 for an adult, although these recommendations are always kind of in flux. A lot of organizations will now say that it should be less than 120 over 70 or even that lower is better. Go ahead.
So why is the number higher on top? That means that your heartbeat is pushing the blood faster.
So basically it means that your heart is having to work harder to push the blood through your arteries, either because your arteries are not as compliant or because you have too much blood in circulation. You see that a problem in older people. Often if their kidneys are not very good, they're not able to excrete a lot of the water that they take in, and so they get a buildup of just blood in the veins. So a lot of different things can contribute to that, but it indicates that your heart is having to work harder, work against a higher load kind of to get the blood going. And that's one reason that you'll see people with very high blood pressure, if you look on autopsy at their heart muscles really thickened. And that's because their heart is having to really work to push the blood out. And this is also one of the reasons that high blood pressure can put you at risk for a heart attack, is that if your heart is having to pump that hard to get your blood out, it's working pretty close to the capacity that it can, given the blood supply that you have. So there's not much of a margin. If you start losing a little bit of blood supply, then that can be a lot harder on a bigger heart than if you had a thinner heart muscle that wasn't having to work as hard. Does that kind of make sense? If you look at pre-hypertension, again, these values are somewhat in flux, but if you look at blood pressure between 120 and 140-ish over 80 to 90, then that's considered you're starting to have a little problem with your blood pressure. It's not necessarily at a really dangerous level, but you need to start working on that. And then hypertension is above 140 over 90. So this is the sphygmomanometer, and there's actually this manometer. You remember that video? She put it here, and if you want to see the video, then you can look online. Since our lecture is kind of long today, I'm going to skip it for now. If we have lots of time at the end, we can watch it. But we're going to talk a little bit about how you measure blood pressure, and then we have blood pressure cuffs and stethoscopes, and we're going to let each of you take each other's blood pressure. So the way that a blood pressure cuff works in general is you're going to raise the pressure in the cuff high enough that it's going to stop blood flow into that extremity, usually the arm. And then you'll gradually release pressure. At some point, the pressure that you're applying is going to be greater than the diastolic but less than the systolic pressure. And you'll start to hear the blood going through because it's having to squeeze through a narrowed space and it makes kind of a whoosh noise. And that's called a Karat cough sound. Once you continue to lower that pressure, eventually the artery is able to open fully and you get kind of a laminar flow through it. It's not making that sound anymore and you lose the sound. And so where the sound begins is your systolic pressure and where the sound ends is your diastolic pressure. And when we hand these out, I'll ask, I know it's temptation to talk a lot when you're not asking to listen to the lecture. But if you're quiet, you'll be able to hear the sounds a lot better. This is kind of just a pictorial demonstration of what I was just telling you. When you put the blood pressure cuff on, you want these two wires, I guess, that are lumens that are going into it, to be more or less over your brachial artery, so over the inside of your elbow. And if you feel there, you can feel a pulse, probably, especially if you have your arms straight. You're then going to put the stethoscope over that pulse, if you can find where it is, and then inflate the cuff. When the cuff inflates above your whatever your systolic pressure is, as shown, the artery squeezes shut. As it starts to go down, the artery starts to open up, and you're going to get this turbulent flow through where you'll start hearing sounds. And then when it gets below the diastolic pressure, the arteries open and you no longer have sound. And let's just go ahead and do this part now. Eva, help me hand. Let's start with one per two people. I think that's going to work the best. Can you hand this down? Do you guys have one? Okay, there you go. Let's give one more for this. You need one more in this row? Do we need one more here? Do y'all need another one on this row? Do we currently have one cuff per every two people? Does anyone need another one? Okay. As a rule of thumb, if you inflate it to about 150, then you'll probably catch, hopefully, everybody in this class on the way down. The other thing is, if you let the air go at a rate of about 2 to 3 millimeters of mercury per second, that's a good rate. Okay? Would you like to take my blood pressure?
I'd love to take your blood pressure.
The last time I did this was like 2 years ago.
That's okay. The last time I did it was probably a year ago. No, you were right the first time.
Like this?
Yeah. And where it says artery, goes over the artery.
Yeah, so right there. Mm-hmm. Is that good? All right, you can stick two fingers in there?
Yeah, it's fine.
Yeah?
Okay. I'd say at least half of these people have their stethoscopes in backwards.
Oh, really?
Oh, it really
can play itself. like 110 over 83.
Okay.
Yeah.
110 seems reasonable. 83 is a bit high.
83 seems low.
Seems high.
Seems high.
I'm going to get your earpiece. Sure. Hey guys, be a little bit quieter. Is anybody having trouble who wants me to take a look at? Is anyone else having trouble making this work? All right, everybody, we're going to get started again. Did everybody successfully measure someone's blood pressure or get their blood pressure measured today? Anybody over 120 over 80? Look at all you healthy people. Good. Let's talk a little bit about cholesterol. You have in your cholesterol, they divide it up into triglycerides, LDL, and HDL. I guess I'm the only person in here who's actually had their cholesterol checked. But when you do get it done, all right, one other person with me, you'll get your total cholesterol, and then they'll give you these different subdivisions. And so, in general, higher HDL is good. This is the lipid that actually removes the cholesterol from your blood vessels, takes it back to the liver. So you want to have a higher HDL, and that's cardioprotective. LDL is the one that gets deposited in your arteries. You don't want to have a lower LDL. And, sorry? So it's a kind of a, gosh, how do I explain this? It's a fat that has a very specific structure. So it's something that gets absorbed when you're eating. And it also is produced separately by your liver. And so if you're eating too much or if you have, like, a family problem where you make too much cholesterol, then that's when you get high cholesterol. It goes around in your body in these little, they're not really micelles because they're smaller than that, but it goes to your other cells to be taken up and used. But if you have too much for the rest of your cells to use, then whatever extra continues to float around and eventually can get caught along the walls of your arteries. Every animal has cholesterol. Plants don't. So I hope that was helpful. I'm not sure if it was. But in general, these are the guidelines as far as desirable, borderline, and abnormal for your cholesterol level. Brief overview of the cardiovascular system. And there's actually a video that I'm going to show in 1 minute. But this is where your heart is, approximately, in your chest. It's a little bit to the left of midline, sandwiched between your lungs. Your esophagus and everything runs behind it. And actually, your aorta as well goes up and then runs behind your heart to go down into your belly. The right side of the heart collects all of the, I think there's another figure in a second. The right side of your heart collects everything coming in from your body that has had most of the oxygen or some of the oxygen removed. It then goes through your lungs back into the left side of the heart, and the left side is responsible for pumping it out to the rest of your body to go through the whole cycle again. If you look at this diagram in general, this is your superior vena cava. It collects all of the blood from your head and upper extremities. This is your inferior vena cava. It collects everything from your heart down, basically, and returns it to the right atrium. The right atrium then empties into the right ventricle, which pumps the blood up through the pulmonary arteries. They're called pulmonary arteries because they're leaving the heart, but they actually carry deoxygenated blood. That's one that I have always had trouble wrapping my head around. You have left pulmonary arteries to your left lung, and then there's right ones that go under the arch of the aorta to your right lung. Then, after being oxygenated, the blood comes back through your pulmonary veins, again, veins because they're coming back to the heart, but they have oxygenated blood, unlike your systemic veins. And there's two that will come in from this side and two that come in from back here, into your left atrium, into your left ventricle, and they get pumped out through the aorta. And these three vessels are the main vessels to your head and arms, and then the rest of the blood goes down through the descending aorta and gets piped to various other parts of your body through there. Now, I pulled up these things before, so let's just look at them real quick. That's not what I want. Okay. One of these will actually show an animation of the heart. They actually both show animations of the heart, but I like this one better. And it's going to show just what I told you, how the blood is coming in through the vena cava into the right heart, out, back into the left heart. All right, so we won't be watching those videos. Moving on. As far as quantifying your heart performance, we've already done today one of the ways of quantifying your heart performance. You can take your blood pressure. You can also look at heart rate, how many times your heart beats per minute. Normal is anywhere from 60 to 100, really, although it depends on who you are. If you're a little bitty baby, they tend to have very much higher heart rates. And so a heart rate over 100 is completely normal. Whereas in an older person, a heart rate over 100 means something's wrong, generally, because they just don't get their heart rate going up that fast unless something is wrong. Your stroke volume is the amount of blood that actually comes out of your heart for each beat. A normal value is 60 to 80 milliliters. If you multiply your heart rate, which is beats per minute, by your stroke volume, which is volume per beat, you can get volume per minute, which is your cardiac output. Your normal volume per minute, or cardiac output, is about 4 to 8 liters per minute. And your total blood volume, depending on your size, how big of a person you are, will be somewhere around 5 liters, but it could be less than that. Certainly for children, it's less than that. It could be more than that if you're a real big guy, you know, you could have a volume that's closer to 6 or 7 liters. So what this means is basically that your entire blood in your body is circulating completely every minute, which is kind of neat. Other ways of quantifying heart performance is ejection fraction. This is something that's really important to look at in people who have heart failure because their ejection fraction is a really good predictor of how well they're going to feel and how well they're going to do. This is a fraction of blood that's pumped out of the ventricle as a proportion of the total amount that the ventricle has at the end of diastole. So when it's completely relaxed, the ventricle is as big as it's going to be, holding as much blood as it's going to. How much of that actually gets squeezed out with the beat? So if you imagine that all the blood got squeezed out and there was no space left in that ventricle, then that would be 100% ejection fraction. That doesn't really happen. But you, in a normal person, it'll be somewhere above 60%. So you'll have more than half of the total blood in your heart, in the ventricle of your heart, pumped out with each beat. It's measured using echocardiography, which we'll look at right now. No, we won't, actually, because that's another one that's online. But if you'll, when you're home, if you're interested, go and look at these, they're little movies of actual echocardiograms in a normal heart, and then a heart with dilated cardiomyopathy. If you get someone who has heart failure whose heart is not able to pump effectively, you can get ejection fractions of anywhere down to like 10%. And those are people who, in general, feel short of breath just sitting. They don't have any real potential to exercise because they just aren't getting the blood out to their bodies effectively. Heart attacks. It's certainly something we've all heard of. We've seen on TV that falling over. But heart attacks aren't always that obvious. And this case study, we may actually get to go through it later, but I'm not sure if we're going to have time. Actually, we will have time because the other things we're going to look at are on the internet, and I can't get to them. So let's do a case study real quickly to talk about what a typical patient coming in with a heart attack might say. So 3 months following his first visit to your office, Mr. Solomon presents to the ER in the early morning with chest pain of 1 hour duration. He describes the pain as being severe and like someone is sitting on my chest. And this is a classic description for those of you who are going to go to medical school that you'll hear. The classic description of a heart attack is, it feels like an elephant is sitting on my chest. He says that this pain is located in the lower part of his breastbone and awakened him from his sleep. He tried to relieve the pain by changing position, sitting up, drinking water. Nothing really seemed to help. He said, I didn't sleep well because I had an upset stomach and an acid-burning feeling. But he attributed this to overeating and drinking at a Christmas party. No pain or discomfort in his arms, but says he has an achiness in his left jaw. And he says, well, my teeth are bad. It's probably just my teeth. But this is another thing that you'll hear a lot with a heart attack, is that you can get pain not only in the area over the heart, but it can go in the arm, in the jaw, in the back, upside of the face. And this is called referred pain or radiation of pain. He when you do a physical exam, you see that he's anxious, pale, diaphoretic, which means he's sweating, and he's in obvious discomfort. He's unshaven and accompanied by his wife. He tries to relieve his pain by belching, coughs occasionally, says, oh, the flu's been going around the office. I've had a little cough and fever all week. Well, some of the early warning signs of a heart attack, the symptoms may start slowly, kind of come and go. You may get chest pain when walking, but not when you stop, then it goes away, this kind of thing. And those aren't heart attacks, but that's angina. That's an indication that the heart muscle is not getting the oxygen that it needs and that it's reacting to this by sending you these pain signals. At first, people tend to have it more when they're exercising because that's when their heart needs more oxygen to increase the blood supply to the body. And so then when they stop exercising, well, it goes away because then the heart muscle is not having to work as hard. It's still getting enough oxygen. But these are all warning signs that there's already some insufficiency in the amount of blood that's getting to the heart muscle. The chest discomfort will usually last for more than a few minutes, or it may go away and then come back. It can feel like a pressure, a squeezing, fullness, or it can be outright pain. Most people aren't going to have the clutch their chest and fall over that you see in the movies. It's usually more subtle than that. And this is a problem because if you have a terrible pain, you fall over, you know, go to the emergency room, something's wrong. But if you just feel like you have a little bit of indigestion, you know, maybe you have some achiness, but you're not sure what could be causing it, you're not going to know to go to the doctor. And the first 90 minutes of a heart attack are really a crucial time. And if you can't get to the hospital during that time, then the risk of complications is a lot greater. You also can get shortness of breath, and it can occur before the chest discomfort begins. And so I think this is what they were getting to when they said, oh, well, the flu's going around. I've had a bit of a cough. I felt kind of short of breath. You can also have the cold sweat, nausea, or lightheadedness. This was a video that was going to talk all about the signs, and it has a couple of different people describing when they had a heart attack and how they really thought it was something else until it had progressed quite a bit. And it encourages people, if you think you may be having a heart attack, go in to the doctor, because the worst thing that happens is you're wrong. And that's not that bad on the scale of things. These are the arteries that supply the heart. So even though the heart is full of blood, it's thick enough that the oxygen and everything that's in the blood inside the heart doesn't diffuse out to all of the heart muscle. So the heart muscle actually has to have its own blood supply, which is in the form of the coronary arteries. In people who have coronary artery disease, as shown here, these arteries can form plaques and can become narrowed and not give as much of a blood supply to the heart. These are just some histological pictures of blood vessels showing the different layers. You have the internal intima, lumen. There's going to be an endothelial layer around the lumen. And then layers of smooth muscle and elastin. This is showing atherosclerosis of the aorta. You can see how it's not smooth. It has a very lumpy kind of appearance. It looks kind of greasy. And that's where you've gotten some buildup of cholesterol and deposits along the aorta. There was another movie, and I think we're going to again have the same problem with not being able to get on the internet, but which just showed how this would form and eventually could rupture, releasing some of the contents of the plaque or causing a clot to form on top of the plaque, which can either block at this level or can go be shot out through that artery and go somewhere else where it can embolize and cause problems in that end organ. This shows an artery that has a markedly smaller lumen. Here's the lumen. This is all vascular smooth muscle cells. That's, I think, what that means. This is the internal elastic lamina. And this, you can see, is an almost entirely occluded artery. Maybe a little bit of blood can squeeze through some of these places, but for the most part, especially if you're someone who already is not getting a real good blood supply to your heart, if you're down to this level, you're just going to have severe problems with getting oxygen to that heart muscle. And this shows the same thing. The clot starting to build up, eventually builds up and can form a clot. You know what? I'm just going to try one more time to get this to work. Come on. Yeah, I don't think it's going to do it. Thanks anyway. Okay. So, as far as in the first, if you do know that you're having a heart attack or you recognize these signs and you manage to get to a hospital, what can they do for you? Acutely, if you come in the first couple hours, they can actually use TPA, which is tissue plasminogen activator, and this is something that will break down clots. So if you have a clot that forms that blocks off that vessel, if you can give this drug before the heart muscles actually completely run out of oxygen and die, then you can actually help save a lot of the heart muscle. And so this is approved for use in certain patients having a heart attack or a stroke, either of which can be caused by a blood clot. They did a number of clinical studies and decided that these could, in fact, reduce the amount of damage to the heart muscle, save people's lives, but really only if given in a few hours after the symptoms begin. After your heart muscle has been without oxygen for a long period of time, the cells are dead. You can't bring them back to life just because you bring oxygen back. This is administered intravenously in a hospital. And if patients are treated within the first 90 minutes, they are 1/7 as likely to die as patients who are treated after 90 minutes. There are risks associated with these drugs. If you are someone who already has some sort of bleeding problem, then these are contraindicated. If you're known to have any sort of bleeding within your head, these are contraindicated. Because if you have a clot that has formed there, that clot's going to dissolve too. And so there is a risk of having intracranial hemorrhage. This is a greater risk in older people. Those are people more likely to have some sort of bleeding problem already. And these patients may require further intervention. Also, patients who have any kind of gastrointestinal bleed, you are very hesitant to use any sort of clot-breaking drugs because you're actually going to cause more bleeding there. In general, these thrombolytics are not inexpensive by any means, although tissue plasminogen activator is much more expensive than streptokinase by almost an order of magnitude. If you look at effectiveness, a very large clinical trial, which involved 15 countries and over 1,000 hospitals and over 40,000 patients, looked at four different strategies. These patients are randomly assigned to either receive streptokinase and subcutaneous heparin, and heparin prevents clots, whereas the streptokinase breaks up clots. Or streptokinase and IV heparin, or accelerated tissue plasminogen activator and IV heparin, or all three of these, IV heparin plus tissue plasminogen activator plus streptokinase. And their primary endpoint was who's still alive in 30 days? What percentage of these patients die within the first 30 days? And when they looked at these, they found that with all of these therapies, you had about 6 to 7% mortality. It looks like accelerated tissue plasminogen activator and IV heparin actually had the lowest mortality at 6.3%, but it also had one of the higher risks of stroke, although not as bad as if you gave everything that you could throw at this. Then you had a higher risk of stroke at almost 1%. The lowest risk of stroke was with the streptokinase and subcutaneous heparin, which was about 0.5%, but you didn't have quite as low of a mortality rate. And one of the other things you have to factor into this is if you remember how much more expensive the tissue plasminogen activator was than the streptokinase, that's also something that may be important when you're looking at what is the best therapy that we can give for patients. Looking at cost effectiveness, if you use tissue plasminogen activator post-myocardial infarction, which is a heart attack, high-risk patients, that you spend $3,600 per year of life saved. Using TPA in the acute setting of a heart attack with a large infarct, so you have a big area that has lost blood supply, and treatment is started 2 hours after, which we already said it's most effective in the first 90 minutes, well, then you're talking about $24,000 per year of life saved. Now, this is the interesting part, I think. If you invested in counseling to get people to stop smoking, you would only spend $1,300 to $3,900 per year of life saved. So smoking cessation and counseling for that can be a huge impact on people's lives. And then if you look at coronary artery bypass graft in patients who have two-vessel disease and severe angina, and that's what I was saying, where you have chest pain, but it's not a heart attack, it's just an indication that you're getting some loss of blood supply to that muscle. And that's going to cost you anywhere from $9,200 to $42,000. diagnosis of atherosclerosis is often done through imaging techniques, and this actually shows, this is the bed that they would have you lie on. These are all the doctors actually doing this, and what they'll do is go in through the femoral artery generally and inject dye into, they'll go up through all the arteries, inject dye into the coronary arteries, and then image it, and the dye is radiopaque, so you can see it on the radiographic film. And so this shows, this is actually what you would see on the computer screen, and then that's the heart showing similarly where the blood vessels run. This indicates what you would see if you had someone with an atherosclerotic lesion. Just kind of this dark spot where it appears that the dye is not getting through very well. This person here has two such lesions, and they don't actually show up that well on this. They're easier to see on the screen. That one's kind of easy to see. You can see like the black spot right there. This one, you kind of have to imagine. Squint and imagine. And this is a gentleman who is going to talk to us a little bit. Maybe.
Biomedical engineering is quite dear to me. I took my graduate degree and my master's is in biomedical engineering from Iowa State University in Ames. And I took a PhD in biomedical engineering there as well. My interest and one of our focus points here at the University of Texas Cardiology is hemodynamics, blood flow.
He's not moving, is he?
And
I thought he was just not very animated. Okay. I have this actually on the CD as well, so let me see if I can pull it up separately and make it a little less weird. Oh, I wonder if this will play. Nope. Let's see where I put it. Here we go. Now he's moving. Let's skip this first part.
This is a laboratory where we do a lot of experiments aimed at trying to better understand blood flow both through the coronary arteries and into the tissues downstream of those vessels, the actual myocardial or the heart muscle that must be perfused in order to function properly. So in our department, we have several engineers, electrical engineers and former aerospace engineers, myself included, who have come to take our engineering expertise and bring it to internal flows inside the body. What we have here is a research lab where we can do a lot of different things. This device over here is a digital angiography system whereby we can look at the boundaries, we can look at the anatomy of the coronary arteries, and we can do certain types of analyses with computers that are attached to this. We can delineate the size of the arteries, what the boundaries of the vessel look like. We can determine how much disease is in those coronary arteries. And we can also look at how the blood is flowing through the arteries. The table over here has an instrumentation surrounded by it. These days, in studying coronary blood flow, we're really aided by miniaturization and electronics and a lot of the work that's gone into well logging from the petroleum industry. Just as in logging wells and mud logging technologies, you want to get information from the site, and so you put down various types of sensors to determine the gas content, consistency, structure of the soils. We do essentially the same thing here using very small, about one millimeter and smaller size probes that can look at velocity profiles, can look at instantaneous pressures. We can also use those for drug delivery devices, and we can use those for mechanical interventions where we can inflate a balloon and squash out or remold a diseased coronary artery. We can also put in essence, a chain link fencing that we call a stent inside of the artery and open it up and keep it open so it doesn't close up again. These are all things that are done in cardiology. But before they actually get to the clinic, before they actually get into patients, they have to be rigorously tested through FDA-type procedures, And this is a lab that does that type of work, looking both at how well those devices work, how easy they are, and how effective they are in helping restore blood flow. So we use a lot of this electronic equipment and computers for running these types of tests. We can do things such as putting down radioactive microspheres, small types of tracers from which, from the pattern and from the radioactive information that we get from those isotopes, we can determine how much blood flow is actually getting down into the tissues. We also have computers back there for doing digital image processing of the coronary angiogram, which we acquired here in real time from the animals that we investigate. And this is the same type of equipment that's used over in the clinical, that is the human cardiac cath laboratories, so to investigate patients with disease. So we can readily transfer the things that we find here in this research lab. Using the same types of technology, we can readily transfer those to the human lab, and that's one of our objectives, is not just to be an academic center, but to use that information quickly and effectively for treating patients. This is the cardiovascular imaging laboratory, and we do a variety of things here, but primarily aimed at visualizing and quantifying the types of diseases that one sees from coronary angiogram. Coronary angiogram, this is essentially how your heart sits inside your chest. And these red lines here are representations of your coronary arteries, of which there's three major ones. And these coronary arteries are the real site of a lot of our interest, because these are the ones that become clogged up when you eat too much cream cheese, too many hamburgers, too much barbecue brisket, too much french fries. And what accumulates inside the arteries is stuff that feels very much like sort of a Camembert cheese, squishy and kind of slippery, and that's the cholesterol that we all worry about. Well, when those buildups occur, you can't see from the outside, but from the inside, you can see these deposits, and they start to, just like a rusty pipe that's getting clogged, it starts to narrow down and narrow down, and that can lead to all sorts of problems. One, it becomes harder to push the blood through,
homework 13 is due. And I had written that exam 2 would be handed back on Thursday, but that's not actually true because we have it today. So I actually got you out a few minutes early. Anybody want to see the Menomina video? No, I didn't think so. Go home. Come get your test. And actually, if y'all could bring these back up, put everything in the bag, zip it, and throw it in the box, it'd be great. I was like, I heard my name. What's up? I have office hours all the time. No, I have office hours tomorrow from 1:30 to 2:30. I have them on Friday from 12:30 to 1:30. It's all on the website, too, so that might be the easiest way to do it. If you go to the, I think it's on the syllabus, like, main page, it has all of our office hours.
Would it be a good one tomorrow? I just have questions about how to use the metrology to get out, you know?
Sure, yeah, not a problem. I should be there all afternoon, but I'll certainly be there during my office hours, especially if I know someone's actually coming.
Is it in the bio?
No, it is actually in George R. Brown, which is the next building that way. You want to just write it down? I'm going to tell you where it is. Might be the easiest. I don't actually, but I'll find out. Okay. I know it was higher than last time. Okay. I am in George R. Brown, so GRB. And it's W204. Okay, well, to give you an idea, that building, here's the road, it's shaped like this. It has like two sides. I'm on the west one, which is further this way. That's what the W is for.
There we go, okay.
And then you can go in a door that heads you towards the street or heads you towards the back. Head towards the back.
Do you know what the grading looks like, what an 8 is?
I don't actually.
Okay.
Yeah, I should probably try to find that out and get back to you. What is an A? What is a B? What is a? There you go. Like I've lost my English. Yeah. Well, I know that people did better than last time.
Yeah, I know.
I have not, but I know they're on Notes from Home on the website. Yeah, I think they can sign into OwlNet as well. Ryan, I'm not sure what it is. You want me to just give something to him?
Yeah.
Does he know this is coming?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's
Oh, I'll just take it up to him. That's
okay.
Fine.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Do you know when the book report is due?
She said it was 2 weeks after she posted it, so it'll be sometime next week, I guess.
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
I'll start off.
Back up.
Is it just a summary that they're typing out?
Yeah, it's just a book report, as far as I know. It just has to be one of like the books on her list. They have to get permission. Yeah. Although I got permission to add a couple to the list, but I haven't. Oh well.
Excuse me.
Ingrid Norberg.
You're welcome.
Peter Yang.
Johanna Andres Chavez. But that's not your grade, just so you know. Vincent Malouf. Alex Gordon. You're welcome. Nancy O'Connor. Thanks. Bailey Rodriguez. Jason, I can't read. Last name is A.
Altabelli.
Altabelli, there you go. Emma John. Sarah Conlin. And Justine Williams. There you go.
Last one.
There you go. Yeah. Who? And Sergi, you're welcome. And then Rory,
Ivy.
You're welcome.
The math
one. She said, I think the math is wrong.
Oh, really?
He's off by 10. It shouldn't be up, it's like 1, just 2.5, that's 10.
It may be. Sorry.
It's off by 10.
I thought I'd checked it, all of them, double checked them all, but I may have missed one.
All right, well, I will go change that because I've changed it online.
Okay.
And so.
Good catch. I'm sorry.
Curve, no, the average is an 85, though.
Oh, you do know the average. Okay. Someone asked me, and I was like, oh.
Yeah, Sakai calculates it for you.
Yes, it's nice. I'm sorry. Make it go away.
So, yeah, I'll take that. Take that back. So that should be a 98.5. Is that right?
Yeah, so it should be a 98.5.
Okay.
So I'll change this.
See, I tell you, I've lost my ability to do simple math, even with a calculator.
Like, oh God, that made me sit there and hit my head.
Yeah. Cool.
I'm like, where's my calculator? And it's like, well, let's just look at what points are off. I'm like, yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Good job. Great lecture, yeah.
Someone wants to come and talk to me about tetralogy of Fallot tomorrow. I'm glad she gave me the heads up so I can remember what that is. I mean, I kind of remember, but, yeah. Because I turned it off?
Oh,
no, I didn't turn that off. I turned my laptop off. Oh, I saw this on.